James was exhausted, but he changed Cato, gave him to me, and sat by me as I fed him. Cato was quiet. I tried not to look at him, but every time I did, his devil eyes would dart at me. I closed my eyes. "What's wrong?" James asked. "Nothing," I said quickly. We closed the heavy curtains. James put Cato in the cot, and he and I lay in bed. I tried to sleep. My mind was racing. Next to me, I could hear James snoring, and I heard Cato's steady breath. "I just need to make it to morning," I thought. "Morning will be a new day. The old world just needs to be destroyed in order for a new one. You have to break the walls to build them anew," I thought. I'm not sure if I slept then, but then the next moment, my eyes were open, and I heard a voice. It was a voice in my head, my own voice, but it spoke with clarity and strength. Each time it spoke, the room filled with light. Where was the light? The curtains were still drawn. There was a darkness in the room, but the light was trying to fight. Somehow, I felt instinctively, I knew it was the voice of God. I felt his presence in the lights, in the dawn. I immediately felt a sense of calm. "God? Your son needs to die." The voice was simple, straightforward. The light was shining dimly now, but I could sense it fighting. "What?" I felt panic taking over my body. "Please, no, please." "Are you trying to bargain?" "No, I'm not trying to bargain." I started to cry. I felt helpless. What did this mean? What was happening? I didn't understand. I thought we were going to be safe. I thought we had made it. We had done the impossible thing. We had left the house. I thought that was the test. That was all there was. What if I did bargain? It wasn't under my control. None of this was in my control. I didn't know how to make this nightmare, this dream, stop. I decided to let go. If this was the cost of my happiness, I would accept it. "I accept it," I said. "If this is what's going to happen, I accept it. I accept." I was shaking, terrified, but then I felt darkness come over me, and I felt nothingness, like a hand had been pressed over my face and smothered me. And then there was a dim light, and I could hear the sound of Cato breathing. It sounded steady, but then it stopped, and there was just the sound of the room. And somehow, I knew, even without looking at him, that he had passed. I prayed. I hadn't prayed since I was a child. Faith was something I had felt before, something I had sensed, omnipresent, like a shadow, but it wasn't something I had chased since then. I prayed for mercy. I prayed to not be afraid anymore. I just wanted to stop fighting, to accept. I started to hear Cato breathing again. He was back. He was back. I felt the light, cool and delicate, and then I felt darkness, the smothering again. And I woke up again. This time I was face down, pressed against the bed. The voice was in my head again. "Your son has to die, and it has to be your husband's fault." "That will break him," I said. I thought of James's grandfather, who was responsible for the soup falling on his son's head. He had had to live with the guilt of his firstborn son's death. He was 102 now, so many years to live with the guilt. James, the infallible optimist, how would he survive? "Yes, it will break him, but it will make him stronger. You need to be there to support him. You are his Beatrice." And then the voice was gone. I sensed a finality in its statement. Beatrice. I was James's Beatrice. So James was Dante. I had a thought. Did that mean we were in hell? Had we died in the car, driving in the storm, and woken up in hell? How many circles of hell would we have to travel to reach the end? I lay awake and thought of the evidence of the past day. What was the darkness? What were the demons? The distorted faces. Was I dreaming? Was I dead? Was I in hell? Was this why I couldn't sleep? Was this why I felt the darkness pressing like hands against me? I started to think further, past this day, and I started to see the patterns, fairy tales, the story of three brothers, east and west, the baby who was dropped at a celebration and died, the baby who died when a pot of soup fell on him, James's father the deaf man, my father the blind man, James's mother a reflection of me, Cato growing up to be like James, and in the center, throughout it all, James, James and me and James. It was strangely exhilarating to see these patterns, like putting together a story when there were only pieces before. And through my dread and my fear, I saw the beauty in them, the patterns in the universe. I could tell it was dangerous, this raw energy, this coursing feeling. And for a moment, I wished I could tumble into the madness. I felt like I had caught a glimpse of another dimension, of the void, of the truth, of possibility. This feeling was beautiful. It was terrifying. I would never be able to harness it, I knew. I would never be able to control it. I felt like Icarus, gasping in what was awesome, transcending fear. Because suddenly, I wasn't afraid. It wasn't in my control. I wasn't in control. I surrender, I thought. And when I surrendered, I felt invincible. Because when I looked beyond fear, beyond the terror, all I could see was love. My love for James. My love for Cato. That was love. It belonged above, higher than any force. Was this what my grandmother was warning me about? The force that was love, and I would only know loss. I tried to imagine losing Cato. I knew it was going to happen. I couldn't imagine the searing pain of it, the despair, the love as a destroyer. I would need to be there for James. The next moment, I heard James wake beside me. He smiled, his eyes tired, and he looked at me with concern. "Did you sleep at all?" he asked. "I did," I said. "Actually, I'm not sure," I said truthfully. I saw James's smile disappear as he watched me. His eyes were searching mine. His eyes didn't look trusting anymore. "Oh, cat," James said. I was no longer in bed. I was standing outside of it, striding around the room. I felt powerful. By surrendering, I had won. I was going to hurt today. I was going to lose. But I was ready. I had accepted it. I was ready to leap. James looked at me worriedly. "Cat," he said. Perhaps I'd been talking out loud. I could feel my body emanating energy, emanating light. I was glowing. I was alive. I wanted to be outside, to feel the wind, to scream. "I need to talk to Teddy," I said. "I need to talk to Teddy." I needed to explain to someone who would listen. James was starting to look panicked, and I didn't want to scare him. "I want to go out," I said. "I want to leave this room." "No," James said, "we're going to stay here. I want us to talk. I want to know what's going on." "There's nothing to say," I said. "Let's not overcorrect." The suffocating feeling was back, and then James was pacing the hotel room, back and forth across the red carpet. "Cat," James said, "I think I should call my parents because I need them to take care of Cato. I want you to get some sleep today." I nodded. "Anything to help, James." His voice was echoing. It was echoing. This wasn't right. "Will you let me call them?" he asked. I nodded again. He stepped out of the room. I noticed he took Cato with him. I called Teddy. The conversation was scrambled, but I remember telling him that everything would be okay. I was Beatrice. I didn't know what that meant for now, but I knew that I was Beatrice, and it was my responsibility to get us out of here. "Do you remember?" I asked. "Do you remember being a kid and flying kites?" "Yes," he said. "Don't be scared," I said to him. "You're going to go on a long trip, Teddy. You're going to go around the world." There was silence as I described the trip he had already taken a couple of years before, but this Teddy didn't know about it. This was another life, a version he didn't know. Then, a small voice, I could hear him crying. "Okay, Nuna," he said. "You're going to go to so many places. You're going to sell all your stuff, and you're going to take a tent and a backpack and walk," I said. "And you're going to grow your hair. It's going to be so long, longer than mine." "Okay, Nuna," he said. I could tell he was trying to stop crying. "Whatever James says, you do it. He's going to take care of you. You'll be okay." There's a rush of newcomers on the ward. Will says it's because it's Valentine's Day. I'm not sure what that means. There's Persephone, a woman in her 50s with a bright blonde wig. She's a self-proclaimed psychic. She giggles and laughs like the ward is a newfound delight. Oh, what fun, she says about everything. She loves my slippers. She wants a pair, but they ran out a long time ago. I tell her I claimed mine from the bin. I wonder if the newcomers are involuntary like me. I can't tell if they want to be here or if they want to leave. The newcomers appear without any fanfare. They just show up suddenly in the cafeteria, in the TV room. Some of them greet Tamira and Will with an indifferent familiarity, as though it's expected that they are meeting again. There's never any formal introduction made. I guess the workers are too busy. We learn their names piecemeal, and some don't bother introducing themselves at all. One of the newcomers is a Korean girl who scurries. She has a Bible under her arm, and she keeps her head bowed. She looks like she wants to say something to me, but when she sees me talking to Tamira, she closes her mouth and walks away. Then there's Lorena, a pretty college student with piercings along her ears. She comes in wearing a hospital robe. She has thick cotton bandages around her wrists. She moves hesitantly, like a sparrow. It occurs to me that she looks like prey. Dave barks at her and guffaws when she jumps. She sits next to me gratefully in the TV room as though she's found safety. What's it like here? She asks me. I'm not sure how to answer. What would be the right answer? I'm aware that the workers are listening. It's okay, I say. Everyone is nice. Do you feel safe here? She asks. I see Tamira roll her eyes. Yes, I do. I know that she's scared, and I wish I could think of another way to reassure her. Just be smart, I think. Don't ask questions like these. Be aware. And then, why are you here? She asks. And everyone pauses. Both workers look up from their phones. I stammer. I got sick, I say. I have a baby, and then, well, I was traveling, and I got sick. I was having a lot of stress from my husband's family, and I couldn't sleep. The words tumble. How can I explain? I'm not sure where to begin. Let's watch the damn Olympics, says Tamira. I smile at her gratefully. She doesn't smile back. In the hotel, time bent. I started to see things multiply. My sense of reality was fragmented. It was like I was forming memories that would duplicate, but each with a slight variation. I saw James pacing the hotel room. Cato was in his arms. I saw James pacing the hotel room in a loop. I saw him shaking with our son's dead body in his arms. I saw him again and again, with the same result, our son dead. Copy-paste, copy-paste, copy-paste. Forced to walk around the hotel room in an infinite loop, trying to keep his son alive, but failing. My body on the hotel room bed. I saw this hundreds of times, smaller and smaller images, like thumbnails on a computer screen, a miniature James pacing and pacing, shaking while holding Cato in his arms. I couldn't scream. I couldn't move. I had my hands over my ears, over my eyes. I wanted to stop seeing it. I wanted to stop living it. But here we were, living it again and again. I could hear James's parents in the hallway of red wallpaper. James rushed out with Cato in his arms, and I started screaming. I know, I screamed. We failed. We're in your version of hell. I saw James's mother's face lined with worry, her eyes still darting, his father's face, his arms reaching out to me. Somewhere, James was shouting. I could feel him grab my shoulders to pull me back into the room. He was sobbing. No, just leave. Just leave. He shut the door, but I could still see them standing in the red hallway, as though I was watching a screen projection. My mother-in-law was holding Cato close. I was fracturing. I was splitting into versions. And then, like someone had pressed fast forward in my brain, I skipped ahead. James was crying in the car. We're going to the hospital, he said. He was speaking quickly. He kissed me. And then he smiled. And I saw that boy at the wedding, the one who had thrown a rope to me, who had seen me and pulled me in. You trust me? He asked. I said, yes, I trust you. As he drove, I saw our lives again and again, meeting at a wedding, meeting at a party, at a library, on the street. I saw us jumping off cliffs together. I saw us grow old. I saw glimpses. We had lived them all. We had always met. We had always fallen in love, but it always ended here, in the same place, in this car park, in front of the hospital, yet again. James kissed me fiercely. Let's go, he said. As we entered the hospital, I had the feeling of being on a set. There was a crewman holding a light and someone walking by with cameras. Ah, I thought, I understand. This was a set designed by hell, a set to take the place of purgatory. The receptionist was a demon with ink-dark eyes and a twisted, pointy face. She winked at me. Her eyes danced with merriment. James was standing by the desk, filling in paperwork. Okay, what do I need to do? I said loudly. This was very good, but how do I break his reality? I addressed the demons around me, the ones sitting in the chairs, the ones holding their arms in bandages, the girl who was staring at me without blinking. James shushed me. I sat down. We were never going to be seen. This hospital was a set. We were in purgatory, and James didn't realize. We were never going to be seen. We would be here for all eternity. I tried to think about how to escape it. How did I help James? I was Beatrice. I needed to be the one to guide him through the circles of hell. But what was I meant to do? I tried to find a voice in my head, but there wasn't one. Perhaps I was meant to exit. Perhaps I was meant to restart so that we could begin again and do better the next time. I needed to exit. I thought of the possibilities. Where could I go? How could I do it? But I looked at James, sitting wearily, his face furrowed as he typed messages into his phone. His phone kept buzzing. I needed to exit so that we could restart, but I wasn't going to leave without him. I looked over at the reception desk. The nurse winked at me again. James's lips were chapped. I realized then that he hadn't eaten or drunk anything since the morning. I took his phone and threw it to see if I could get his attention. The girl who had been staring at me picked it up silently and handed the phone back to him. Cat, James said, please. His tone was gentle. Please sit. The room was spinning. Time was passing too quickly. It was all happening at once, each moment pulsing with energy. I collapsed at his feet. I could no longer stand. I could hear James shouting, could I get some help, please? Someone please help me, please. Someone help him, I screamed. Why is no one helping him? I started to pull at my clothes and scream. I pulled my hair as hard as I could. Maybe if I hurt myself, maybe if I did this, I could break James's reality. I could show him that we were in purgatory, that we needed to exit. I felt the demons rush towards me, their faces pressing in gleefully, and their hands pressing on me as they twisted my ankle and pulled me down. I fought and screamed. I fought with all my might, with flailing arms. I scratched, I bit, I kicked. I heard James shouting somewhere beyond me. I felt the hands pull me down to hell. What would happen to me? I had failed. I had failed James. The nurse receptionist's face was there. She was winking at me and laughing. And I suddenly had the thought of an insane asylum. I realized this was my fate, as though it had happened already. My fate was to be committed in an insane asylum for all of eternity. There were clamps on my wrists. I heard James's voice in the distance, as though through a tunnel. I tried to strangle a demon nurse with her name tag. I thought of James's mother. Perhaps she had been through this before. I surrender, I screamed. I remember lights, bright ones. I saw an operating table. I saw demons standing over me, licking their lips and clapping. I was going to be consumed. I was going to be cut open. I was going to be chained. Demons were pulling at me, pulling at my clothes. And then I was being rushed down a corridor. It reminded me of being rushed into the operating theater. Was I going to be operated on again? Was I going to give birth again? What would be my fate? If only I could have got James to exit with me. Next time, I thought. I had failed in this life. I was supposed to get James to believe. next time. I could hear voices around me. They were the voices of my friends, friends from college, friends I had grown up with. Were they with me? My eyes were open, but I could only see light and then darkness. I could hear the voice of Regina, a friend of mine who also had a son, who was saying, "What's wrong with her? Let's get her in the room." The next moment, I was in a bright white room, wearing a hospital robe. The light was so bright, it made my eyes hurt. There was a metal gate latched around the room, tall sheet metal like an accordion. All that was in the space was a table and a chair. I tried moving on the bed, and I heard the sound of metal whooshing. What was that sound? Was it the wind? But we were in a room. There couldn't be wind in here. I was still in restraints, thick belts around my wrists. A tall man with dreadlocks and glasses was smiling at me. I saw his name tag. It said Nimandi, nurse. The lights were bright, blaring in my eyes. I must be dead, I thought. He was holding my hand. His grip was firm, steady. He looked so understanding. I felt at peace. He wasn't a demon. I knew this. He was on my side. "Do you believe in God?" I asked him. "Do you believe in heaven?" He looked at me. 50-50, he said. "I haven't made up my mind, but I'm okay with that." "I'm a nurse here," he said. "Nurse, that's just a label that society has given you. That's just what's on your name tag. I see you," I said. And then I saw him, Nimandi, who spoke with his hands. He had the soul of my friend Regina in him. I could see he was also the author of When Breath Becomes Air, a man who helped those facing death feel less afraid. He was the nurse, the person who gave to his community, who held the hands of the dying and comforted those who mourned. I saw him in the fullest sense of the word. And then I saw that if we were still in hell, Nimandi must be the Archangel Michael, coming to deliver us from hell, from the demons. He smiled gently at me and held my hand in the restraints. "I'm going to take off your restraints," he said, "but I need you to behave and be calm, and then I can bring in your husband. Remember, you're dressed as a hospital patient, so he's going to see you as a patient. I won't let anyone come in the room unless you want them to. This room is a safe space." He unlatched my restraints gently. They were indents on my wrists from where I had struggled in them. He covered my legs with a blanket. He left the room, and when he returned, James was with him. James looked haggard and stood hesitantly in the corner. "Does he know?" I asked Nimandi, and I meant whether James knew that we were in hell. "I know everything," James said. He was crying. "Please stop, Kat. Please stop. You can stop now." What did he mean when he said he knew everything? Did he know that we were in hell? Did he know that there were versions of his life where he was trapped in a hotel room for eternity? Had I ruined his ability to escape? Had I failed him? Perhaps he knew, which meant that he had been trying everything to keep us going, to help us escape hell, to stop us living this loop again and again. Was I not doing something correctly? I was Beatrice. What was I meant to do? "I surrender," I thought. "Now, I believe that you can get out of this. My shift is ending soon, and I'll have to go. So I want to help you get out of here," Nimandi said. He paused. "I believe that you and your husband can walk out of here, but you have to do it together, as a team." He knitted his fingers together like a steeple. "James, he's your anchor. Anything that happens in this room, this is your safe space." He established the rules for me. "I need you to behave," he said. "No screaming. You have to act properly, or they will restrain you again. Remember, people are watching. Remember that you look like a patient." I nodded. I tried to remember every word he said. Nimandi left. James was trying to smile. "I'm sorry," I said. I was truly sorry. Sorry for everything. Sorry for not listening, for ruining James's escape plan. I should have trusted him. I should have surrendered. "Don't be," he said. "I'm sorry for not listening to you. I'm sorry for not realizing. I'm going to get you out of here, but you have to trust me." Where was here? Did he know we were talking about hell? Did he know that we would have to descend? "Where are we?" I asked carefully. It was a test. We're at the hospital. This is the emergency room area, he said. Ah, I thought. So he still didn't know. And in his face, I saw the desperation. I'm going to go talk to the nurses, but I need you to sleep. I'll be back. We'll go home. I feel like we're being watched, I said. I looked into the corners for the cameras. I thought I could hear the whir of them. I could hear loud noises from outside the room, voices and moans. We're being watched, I said. And then I had a vision of us, reflected in a camera lens, zooming out from my perspective. And I could see us, James holding my hand, standing by the bed in front of the metal accordion walls, and me lying on the bed, hands outstretched, the restraints next to me. I looked over at the door. There was a window there, with a blind. The blind was rolled up. Outside the window was bright light, and I saw a long table with people looking at screens and talking on phones. I could see Namandi. He was talking with a demon. The eyes were slanted and dark, its features twisted. Namandi was using his hands and gesturing at us. Then suddenly, there was a face in the window, the face of a demon peering in. He can't come in, I thought. This is a safe space. We probably are being watched. I think this is an observation room, James said. He kissed me. Why don't you sleep? And I'll go talk to the nurses and get us out of here. Just sleep. Just sleep. James's words resonated with me, as did my brother Teddy's. Just listen to James. He stepped outside of the room and he left the door open behind him. I lay in the bed and tried to sleep, but I could hear the sounds of a hospital. Every time I moved, there was a sound of metal. I was in the maternity ward again, listening to the cries of babies, the sound of heartbeat monitors, of whispers. But where was Cato? He wasn't here. Above me, I could hear the sound of a camera's whir. I have to look sane, I thought. I have to look sane. And then, as though a mist had lifted, I wasn't in hell anymore. I was in a hospital room. I had clarity. I could see that there was a metal gate around the room, latched to the door. Every time I moved, the metal curtains made a sound like the opening and closing of a gate. I was in a hospital robe. I had indents around my wrists. My ankle was sore. I must have twisted it. I was lying in a hospital bed. There were bars and leather straps on the sides. I wondered if James would be able to check us out of the hospital. I wondered if this was going to affect my travel insurance. I thought of going home, home to London. Oh God, I thought, what a mess. I've made a mess. I needed to fix it. What would James's parents think? What would James feel? Where was Cato? I felt panicked. I needed to get out of here. I wanted to stand up, run out the door, but I remembered Namandi's words. You look like a patient. You need to behave. I lay stiffly, but I couldn't sleep. My eyes wouldn't close. I got up to straighten the bed. The sheets were lopsided and disheveled. Would I look insane if I was making the bed? Maybe I should just lie down until James comes back. I went to lie back down, but I couldn't lie still. I stood up again, adjusted the bed, and lay back down. James had said this was an observation room. What were they observing? Did I look insane? I stood up again. My ankle was throbbing. It hadn't been throbbing before. I started limping. Would they think I was insane for limping? Why was I limping? I straightened the bedsheets again. I was looking ridiculous. I tried to lie back down and stay still, but my eyes stayed open, alert to the sounds of the hospital. I waited. I counted. But each time I got to 10, I needed to start over. James had left the door open. Where was James? There was an Asian man lying in a stretcher outside the room. He was haggard. His cheeks were hollowed. His face was thin. He was sitting in the stretcher and staring at me. He was cursing in Korean. Fuck. Fuck. A thought flashed in my mind. Was this James? Was James trying to talk to me? Why doesn't she sleep? The man muttered in Korean. No, no. It couldn't be James. We were in a hospital. That was another patient. Where was James? I stepped out of the door to look for him. You can't be out here, a nurse said to me. You need to go back to your room. I'm looking for my husband. She looked at me curiously. Where is he? I'm not sure, I said. He's working on checking us out. We live in London. Mm-hmm, she said. What's the date today? I don't know. I really didn't know the date. But I need to get back to my son. He's waiting for me. Mm-hmm. How old is your son? She asked. He was born 4th November 2017, I said. So how old is he? His 100-day celebration is this Saturday, I said. Why don't you sleep? She asked. I can't sleep, I said. It reminds me too much of the hospital in London. The noises and the lights are keeping me awake. You've been in a hospital before? She asked. I didn't understand the question. I had been in a hospital before, in the maternity ward. Yes, I said hesitantly. The nurse smiled at me. Her eyes were sad. I guess I should have explained what I meant by a 100-day celebration. Go back to your room, she said kindly. Just wait for your husband. He'll be back. He'll explain. In the corner of my eye, I saw Namandi shake his head at me and walk away. Why did the nurse look at me so sadly? Why did Namandi leave? Was I still in hell? Was this not actually a hospital? My thoughts started crowding my mind, and I thought back to the events, to my memories. Had I been right? How much time had passed? I had no sense of time. Was it no longer 2018? Was I actually in the maternity ward? Had I had a baby? Where was the operating theater? Maybe I had lost the baby. Cato. Was there no baby? The thoughts raced through my mind, one after another. The nurse walked me to my room and closed the door. I could still hear the sounds from outside the door. I thought I heard someone laughing. It was a trick. I wasn't in a hospital. I was still in hell. I must have failed. I tried to lie in the bed, but instead I paced the room, limping. Where was James? How much time had passed? My hospital gown was wet in front. What was that? It was milk. I pressed my arms against my chest. My breasts ached. Where was Cato? He must be hungry. How long had it been since he'd fed? I needed to get to Cato. I saw faces look worriedly into the room. Sometimes they were the faces of nurses. Sometimes it was Namandi. Sometimes it was a demon. Fuck. Fuck. I heard the voice of the man muttering in Korean. Why doesn't she sleep? Maybe the man was James. Maybe James had already restarted, and because I wasn't restarting, he had lived an entire lifetime and was now wasting away on a hospital bed. Why was James speaking in Korean? Was it a code? Was he trying to signal to me? Just surrender, my mother-in-law had said. Is that what she had meant? Why couldn't I sleep? Why did James keep saying I needed to sleep? I paced and paced, muttering to myself. I could see myself on a security screen, with my long hair and hospital gown, pacing barefoot in a small hospital room. On the bed, I could see spots of blood. In the nursing home in Virginia, where I played violin, there was a woman who always asked to call her parents. Philadelphia, she'd say. I want to call my mother in Philadelphia. She must be worried about me. Later, when the phones are free, the workers would say. They would smile at each other knowingly, but after the fourth or fifth time, they would just ignore her. There was a Korean woman named Nahi. She reminded me of my grandmother. She spoke Korean with the same lilting Saturi accent of the island people. She didn't speak English, so I would sit and chat with her in Korean. Initially, she didn't speak to me, but on my second visit, she greeted me like I was her daughter. Why is your hair so long now? She asked. Why is it all wet from the rain? It hadn't been raining. She showed me her doll, a broken thing with stringy hair and half-shut eyes. I wasn't sure if she was as unwell as the others. It may have been the language barrier, but she followed the nurse's orders obediently and acted docile, like a child. However, the nurses told me that she had bitten another resident who had tried to take her doll. There was one visit when she was lucid. Let's go to my room, she said. I can show you my view. The room was shadowy. On the table was a comb of mother-of-pearl, a box of Korean snacks. She handed me one. You should eat more, she said, and I smiled because she sounded just like my grandmother. We used to have a tree when I was a child. My brother loved it. My daughter loves to climb trees, too. She stood by the window, and her profile looked like my mother's, a strong nose and high cheekbones. She turned to me, and I saw that she knew I was a stranger. After that visit, she stopped speaking to me and would ignore me when I came in. Perhaps she didn't want to pretend anymore. On my last visit, I sat with the woman who wanted to call her parents. She had had a manicure, and her nails were a frosted coral pink. She was wearing pearls and a diamond pin. She had a ring on each finger. She held my hands in hers as though we had known each other for years. Wake up, sit in a chair all day, and then sleep. It's no way to live. I'm used to going, 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 she said. She was shaking her head, and I could tell that she was about to cry. She was trying not to, but her eyes shone. Don't be sad, I said. I know, she said. I shouldn't be. When I left, she smiled so hard, her tears spilled over. We are eating in the cafeteria. Will says, Jean, did you remember to get me a Valentine? She shakes her head at him, but winks. Later, Jean brings out a cake she's bought for us. The mood is bright, and the workers laugh as they set out the cake on the table. It's a sheet cake that says Happy Birthday, with piped frosting roses in red and green. Jean cuts it into large squares. No arguing over the flowers, she says. We eat the cake with our hands, licking the spun sugar from our fingers. Happy Valentine's Day. I remember my last Valentine's Day with James. I think of the words in his Valentine letter. I love you. Boundlessly, unconditionally, steadily, I love you. Be mine. I'm already yours. And because I think I should, I write Cato a Valentine on a piece of pink construction paper. Dear Cato, this is your first Valentine's Day. One day when you're older, I'll tell you about it. But you should just know for now that I love you. Nuna, I heard my mother's voice. The door was opening. We are here. It's me. I drove 7 hours to see you. She sounded like she was crying. My father stood beside her gruffly. The door opened again. Nuna, we are here. It's me. I drove 7 hours to see you. James stood behind her, looking worriedly at me. The door opened again and again. Nuna, we are here. It's me. I drove 7 hours to see you. My mother said this each time, standing in a different place in the room, sometimes crying, sometimes holding my hand, sometimes sounding angry. What was this trick, I thought, a trick of the light, a reflecting trick? Which was my mother? I lost track of the number of times they entered the room, hundreds of instances, shuffling in, shuffling out. I could hear my father's footsteps in boots. When I looked at their faces, they were blurred, like someone had taken an eraser and smudged them out. I screamed. So I was in hell. I decided that hell was a computer simulation, a simulation of infinite possibilities, and now we had come to this moment, and we were living this infinitely, trapped in an infinite loop. Was this my fate? I tried to make sense of the stories in my life, of the characters. I tried to find the patterns. I could figure this out. If we were caught in an infinite loop, then who was I? Who was James? I thought of James's grandfather and how he had beamed at me the way James had during our first conversation. He had lost his firstborn son, but he had so many grandchildren and great-grandchildren he couldn't keep count of them. Had that been a version of James's life? Was this why his grandfather had been so happy to see me and Cato? Had that been James in another version of our lives? Then who was I? James's grandfather had outlived 3 wives. Was I the first wife? I never knew what happened to James's grandmother, the first wife. Was she put in a hospital like me? Was that me? The thoughts and memories flooded my mind, and each brought a different answer that fit into a pattern with another. Was this what was happening? Was the world continuing on in an infinite pattern? We were all caught in this cycle, making the same mistakes we'd always made. Why had it taken me so long to see? If I was Beatrice, I must have failed. This was my punishment. The first wife, stuck in a hospital room, forgotten for eternity. I was Ariadne, trying to navigate the labyrinth. the Minotaur, but Theseus would leave me behind. I remembered the story of a friend who found out that her father had a first wife who was in an insane asylum. He had left her and remarried. He sent money back each year, and she stayed there, abandoned by her family, waiting, not knowing that time had passed. Was that me? Was I that wife? I surrender, I thought. My parents were in the room again. My mother looked hollow. She was holding flowers in her hands. My father's trench coat looked like a military general coat. Oh God, I thought, it's the Holocaust. It's beginning again. Outside the room, I could hear a building wave of voices. Souls of the deceased, I thought. I heard the sound of a metal gate closing. The walls were closing in. Oh God, I thought, we couldn't stop it. We couldn't stop it from happening again, again and again. Are you in pain? A man asked me. My breasts were leaking. Why? Who was I? I knew this man. The name came to me. James. It was James. Why was James looking at me with such concern? He looked like he was the one in pain. Was I looking in a mirror? Was I James? Time seemed to reflect on itself, reflections of events happening again and again, but with slight variations. Perhaps I was on the other side of a mirror, looking into my reflection. Did that mean that everything I saw was just a reflection of what I was living? I started to imitate the world I saw around me. I was a reflection. James was trying to spoon-feed me. He opened his mouth wide, gesturing at me to open mine. Wait, I wasn't James. That couldn't be right. Where was the baby? Was I the baby? Had I lost the baby? Was that why James was looking at me so gently? Do you have to use the bathroom? He asked me. I nodded at him, at my reflection in his eyes. I was looking at him, looking at me, looking at him. We were reflected there, infinitely. I'm your husband, James said. Say it after me. I'm your husband, I said. So I was James. No, say that I'm your husband. You're my husband. Yes, good. He looked relieved. And you are? I paused. Cato? No. No, your cat, he said. Oh. He started to draw me a family tree with precise lines. I noticed casually that the words were blurred. I couldn't read. How was I meant to exit this loop? I didn't understand how we could restart. I thought maybe we had to sleep. Sleep and wake up, destroy the old world, and live again in the new. We had to exit somehow. We had to exit and wake up. I tried to speak to my parents, to explain about the simulation, to let them know that we were in hell. Perhaps they would understand me, because they had been through this before, hadn't they? Wasn't that why my mother had always told me those stories? Wasn't that why my father had given me books on mythologies? Wasn't that why he had all his rules? I needed them to understand that we were in a trap, in an infinite loop, that we had failed this time and we had to exit. My mother had her hand on my forehead. She was smoothing my hair. It was like hers, long and dark as ink. Amma, I said, James doesn't know, but we have to get him to sleep. I've been trying to sleep. Yes, she said, please, please sleep. I can't. I need James to sleep first. James is sleeping right now. He's sleeping. No, not just sleeping, real sleep. He has to restart. We have to restart the simulation. I saw her face. It was blurring. It looked angry and uncertain. She didn't say anything. She kept patting my hair. Why wasn't she reacting? I felt anger. Where was her sense of urgency? You have to believe me. Don't you believe your daughter? I started to cry. She shook her head fiercely and blinked away tears. Stop it. You're not sounding like my daughter. My daughter would never say these things. And then I knew, when I looked at her, she wasn't my mother, not my real mother. She was a distortion, a trick of this mirrored world. I thought you were real, but I always knew you were a devil, I said. I closed my eyes. I could trust no one. The halls were crowded with people on gurneys. I could hear the sound of moans and screams. People would appear only to be wheeled away moments later. Hell was a busy place, I thought. My mother would walk me to the bathroom. I would pass the station of doctors and nurses. Sometimes they looked like they belonged at a hospital. Other times their faces were distorted and scowling, and I saw them in their true form. One of the patients on a stretcher was wearing the clothes of a rabbi. "I'm sorry," I said to him. "I'm sorry about the Holocaust. I tried to tell my father, but he wouldn't listen." My mother hushed me. I would often see Nemandi speaking to the people on the stretchers. He would turn and smile gently at me through the window in the door. Sometimes I would wave frantically at him, but his back would be turned and he wouldn't wave back. "Yes, Michael, I failed," I would think. What was he thinking of me? Was he disappointed? Outside the room were two guards. I learned that their names were Lane and Fred. They were both big guys, but they spoke to me gently and slowly. I knew who they really were. "Don't worry," I said to Fred helpfully. "In another life, you're a legend, a real hero. You even invent a grill." "Shush," James hushed me. To Lane, I made boxing motions. I hated every moment of training, but I thought to myself, suffer now and live the rest of your life as a champion. "Yeah, cool quote," Lane said. "You said it. In another life, you're a champion, so don't worry about this one." Lane smiled at me and shook his head. Sometimes I saw Teddy, disguised as a nurse or a doctor. "Teddy," I'd yell, "help." He was my foxhole buddy. Perhaps he had always been. I thought of us together as children, whispering to each other as we waited for my father to stop his raging. We knew that we would eventually be safe. The moment would fast forward, like the VCR tapes that would fast forward the strip of tape. "Teddy is in Seattle," my false mother said. "Nuna, he is in Seattle. He's not here." She handed me a mobile phone. "Nuna?" Teddy's voice sounded muffled. I knew we couldn't speak. We were being watched. I saw my mother's face look at me cautiously. I turned away from her. "Nuna, you're going to be okay." "Foxhole buddies," I said. That was our code. Our code to know that we knew what was really going on. We knew the truth. "Yes, foxhole buddies," he said. "Don't worry." Maybe Teddy was watching me from the ceiling. I looked up at the corner of the room where there was a blinking light. I tried to count the number of blinks. It was Teddy. He was telling me that it would all be okay. Teddy was watching from the ceiling. He would make sure the simulation would end. "Just restart it," I whispered. I tried to blink in rhythm to the light. "Just restart." I spoke to my father, the mathematician, to explain about the simulation. "Infinity plus one," I said to him. "Because Teddy knows. He's a mathematician. It makes sense to him. We just needed to do it one time, because this is a simulation." My father listened to me gravely. He waited until I had finished. He finally said, "I can't promise you that we aren't in a simulation. But as far as I know, I promise we are not in a simulation. This is real." I sighed. He looked regretful, and I saw that there was a shadow of a man, a silhouette, one that was filled with loss, a contradiction. He held my hand, and I danced with him to a French song that I heard. We had never danced at my wedding, or at least in the wedding I remembered, but I knew that there must have been a version where we did. I went through the same thing you did, but I did it alone. A nurse was braiding my hair. My hair was wet. I didn't remember her washing it. "You're very lucky. Your husband has been taking such good care of you, and your parents are here." She looked at me. "My husband left me." She looked at me with red pupils, demon's eyes. She pulled the comb through my hair, catching the snarls and carefully brushing them out. She started to braid, pulling one strand at a time, the way my mother used to when I was a child. "You went through this too?" I started to cry. What was this place? Was this a hell for women like me? Were we all demons? I tried to think of an escape plan. There must be a way out. I was becoming desperate. How was I meant to save James? How was I meant to stop this infinite loop? "Catherine, I need you not to be scared, okay?" a demon said to me. "I know you miss your baby." Was I Catherine? I touched my hands to my stomach. My baby? Was there a baby? Where was the baby then? Maybe I'd lost it. I could feel a jagged scar along the bottom of my stomach. What was the scar? I ran my fingers along the raised edges. It was a thick gash parallel to my hip bone. I tried to count, but I couldn't think of the words. There was a buzzing in the room. It was the cameras again. They were rolling. I stared at the blinking red light. Blink. Pause. Sometimes it blinked, sometimes it paused. Outside the door, I heard the voices of my friends, my four closest friends. They were there, disguised as nurses. Why couldn't they come in? Come in, I shouted. I called their names one by one. Why couldn't they come in? It must be because of my mother. I told her to let my friends in. No one is here, she said. There was no one at the door. She was lying to me. I could see their faces peering in. I promise you, your friends aren't here, she said. I was too weary to get up from the bed. Will you promise to let them in next time? Can you promise that? Yes, she said. I promise. She seemed to falter. Her face was blurred. She looked uncertain, like she was malfunctioning. Was that what was going on? I was trapped in a world of robots? Cylons? I had a vision of the nurses, holding screwdrivers as they attached metal plates underneath my mother's face. Robots. It must be robots. Part of the simulation, I thought. Part of the trick. Cat? James came in with red flowers and containers of food. Cat, you need to eat, please. I looked at the food. It was human flesh. My mother made these for you, he said. Poor James. He was being tricked. I shook my head and started to throw the food on the floor, but he looked so sad that even though it repulsed me, I stopped. He set up the table. I pretended not to notice he was serving flesh. I refused to touch it. Please eat, he said. Please, just eat one thing. I shook my head. He looked sadly at me. He looked haggard. How could I get him to realize we were in hell? I wanted to exit. I wanted this to end, but I couldn't leave him behind. I needed him to know. I needed him to believe me. We have to sleep, I said. Yes, please sleep, he said. I need you to sleep with me. I gestured to the bed, quickly, quickly before the guards came in and stopped him. No, he said. Remember, Kat, we've talked about this before. It's against the rules. There are no rules here, I said. It's okay. The rules are in your head. I'm not going to leave you behind. I spoke gently. He shook his head. And so I failed again. I tried to remain calm. I would make him understand. I would. Sometimes I heard the sounds of a baby crying. I could hear the sounds of a woman screaming. Who was screaming? Was that me? And then I heard the sound of a heartbeat. The heartbeat sounded like it was faltering. Was it mine? Was it James? Was James dying? I heard the sound of a metal gate closing, opening, closing. There was a line connected to my wrist. I tugged at it. Someone was piling blankets on the bed, pressing on top of my legs. I couldn't move. I felt paralyzed in my body. I tried to scream, but there was no noise. James brought more containers of food. There were biscuits, my favorite Girl Scout cookies, Oreos, a stack of crackers. There was juice, coconut water, a smoothie. He set them up carefully in a line, his on one side and the reverse mirror image on mine. We sat across from each other on the floor with our legs crossed. Let's have a tasting, James said. He took a sip of the juice. Follow me, he said. I imitated him. Perhaps we were in a mirror again. Refreshing, he said. Refreshing, I said. I paused. James looked so thin. Why don't you eat? I said to him. James was crying. All I wanted was to give you a high school date. You always said you wanted to go on a high school date with me in my hometown. I'm sorry I never did that before. I looked at him with concern. It's okay, I said. You always made me so happy. He hugged me, I hugged him close, and tried to whisper the truth in his ear, but it only made him cry more. I started to recognize the nurses, the same demons. They would appear and disappear, only to reappear again, wearing the same clothes, wearing the same expression. There was a nurse who never looked me in the eye. She would glance at me with fear. I glared at her often, and sometimes I bared my teeth. Roar, I thought. Run, run. Sometimes I saw time fracture, a simulation of moments. James in duplicate, being tortured, living, waiting in a hospital room for eternity with me. And then there was one time when I saw it. As he smiled at me, I saw a version where he left me behind at the hospital. He was dancing with a bride at another wedding, his own. There was a cloud of confetti, and he was sobbing through his vows. I smiled. At least he would find happiness. I was the first wife. I saw that now. I tried to explain to James that he needed to leave. "I'm your first wife," I said. "No," he said. "You're my wife." He pointed at the family tree. "I know," I said, "but you'll find another wife, and I need you to promise that you will, at least in this version." "This version?" I nodded. I didn't want to scare him by letting him know how many versions there were where he was suffering for eternity. I begged James for paper and a pen. He gave me a stack of paper, and I started frantically writing down everything we were saying. If we were in a simulation, if we were being watched, Teddy would need this record to figure out what moment of time we were in. I wrote and wrote furiously. Foxhole buddies. Bad storytelling. Foxhole buddies, foxhole buddies. Cato, you're killing your father. I was trying to stop time, trying to pause the moment. What was the date? What was the time? How do you capture a moment in an infinite loop? I wrote until the pen ran out of ink. Frantic scribbles. Sometimes music would play from the ceiling. James and I would dance. We danced to our wedding song, and I whirled with him and cried as he smiled, because with every turn I was growing older. I was changing. I was Cato dancing with my father. I was a grandmother dancing with my grandson. I was James's first wife dancing to Ray Charles. I was his second wife dancing to a love song. James was trying to keep me in this moment, but it was impossible. We were caught infinitely. I held him close because even if I had him for a moment, a suspended moment, that would be enough. I was still seeing patterns, still seeing connections. Every moment brought a new connection, a new pattern. The patterns, the connections I was seeing, there were too many of them and too many parallels. The stories and warnings my mother had told me were taking shape, I thought. Those stories had all been to prepare me for my fate, to give me strength for this moment. I saw that now. I had to be strong. I could not bend. Shimchong and her blind father. Was I going to drown in the ocean? Would I be reborn? Nongge dancing off the cliff. I was meant to be a sacrifice, to stop the oncoming tide. I started to draw flowers, flowers on the paper, on the walls. I was Ophelia, dancing with flowers in my hair. And then Cato was there. He was standing outside the door. He was an adult now, and I an old woman. When had that happened? Had my life passed and I had forgotten it all? Was I in a nursing home? I looked at my hands. They were wrinkled, dry, my grandmother's hands. "Cato," I said. I wanted to see him. I wanted to see him before I forgot him again. "He's not here," my mother said. "I have to see him. He's standing outside. Please, let him in." I clutched at her shoulder. It felt frail in my arms. I could crush her. I could break this metal. Then she would see. She would see. "I have to see him. Let me see him." I shook her. "No," she said. I saw fear in her eyes. "No, you can't open the door." And then I sensed it. The moment was gone. Cato was gone. Dead. Disappeared. My chance had passed. And for the first time, I wept. "I'll never forgive you," I said.